You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting from Burnaby, BC. Follow us on social media at CJSF on Twitter, on Facebook and Instagram at CJSF Radio. Listen to old episodes and special programming on our SoundCloud at CJSF 90.1. Diverse, independent, and yours.
Hello, and welcome to the Canadian Philosophy Show. My name is Aaron Wang, and today I'm joined by my co-host, Mihai Kovasser. I'm continuing a series on the idea of progress. Last episode, we covered the concept of progress, what it is, what we think it might be, and some problems we have conceptualizing it. Today, we're talking about pre-Enlightenment thought with regards to the idea of progress. There's a question about whether ancient philosophers had an idea of progress, and so that's a matter of contention. However, it is clear, as this article states, that figures of antiquity who exerted the most influence on later thinkers did not believe in progress in the robust sense used in this article. Plato and Aristotle hold a cynical view of human affairs. They allow that certain developments occur spontaneously, but also see disaster and decline as inevitable. In The Laws, Plato proposes that human society begins with the family, then moves through intermediate forms, and finally arrives at the city-state. In The Politics, Aristotle also presents the progression of forms. Not only is man a political animal, as a matter of fact, it is also true that human excellence is only possible within a city-state with a good constitution. But unhappily, there is no tendency for the city-state, once achieved, to realize or maintain such a constitution. For instance, while Aristotle cautiously admits that laws can and should improve, Book 5 of Politics shows that all constitutional forms, bad and good, are unstable. So this first idea of, with regards to progress of society, progress of human society, the idea of progress as an ideal of how the world should be, that when we look at an ideal world, it should contain a concept of progress, basically comes down to a sense of, well, we want there to be such a thing as a good society. We know that there can be such a thing as a good society, but we have seen inherent instabilities in human societies, which seem to be a limit towards any type of further progress. And given that Plato and Aristotle lived a long, long time ago in the past, before modern concepts of representative democracy or modern technology, that could have changed. So I'll bring Mihai in to comment on this. What do you think? Do you think that our idea or our conception of progress should change in light of what we know now in the modern condition?
Interesting. Yeah, I'm quite excited to get into this subject because I'm a fan of pre-Enlightenment study and you know, studying pre-Enlightenment thought. So there's that, and also this concept of progress I think is really interesting. So I'm happy to be on the show for this. Just before I get to your question, there's a couple things I want to comment on in terms of what you just read. So it says specifically, the first sentence here in this Stanford Encyclopedia article says, whether any ancient philosophers proposed a doctrine of progress is a matter of scholarly contention. So I think it's important here to differentiate between a doctrine of progress or progress as conceptualized today, which ties into the question you just asked me, and progress the way it might have been seen in the pre-Enlightenment period. And the reason I say that is because when we're talking about pre-Enlightenment thinkers like Plato and Aristotle, they live in a very different world to us philosophically, conceptually. They live in a world that, as one of my professors put it, is enchanted in a sense. Right, where gods exist, where forces of nature are, you know, products of some conscious force for the most part, where fate is predetermined, for example, though of course all of these are matters of debate amongst the Greeks, but in large part they saw their world as having an order that maybe ours doesn't, what people would say nowadays, that the universe doesn't have necessarily. right? And I think that comes from a sense of expanding our, as you say, our scientific knowledge, of understanding that there is a lot of randomness in the universe, that a lot of things can be explained. A lot of the phenomena that the Greeks were seeing that they explained through conscious entities, we now explain through what we understand about science, right? So this enchantedness slowly dissipated. But at the time, they really, a lot of that was pervasive in the way that they thought. And I'll come up a little bit in the next paragraphs that we'll work through here. But in terms of classifying progress then versus now, I think it's impossible to see progress in the same way today as the Greeks might have seen it back then. And that's just a matter of the fact that, again, the world they saw was different. Their world was also limited in the sense that leaving the Earth is not something that really crossed their minds in any practical sense. I know you and Mike talked a lot about the environment versus development and how those are different definitions of progress, right? But you have to imagine that in a world like this, those options are far more largely limited than what we have today, right? So when we're talking about progress in the ancient times like this, I would think that, as it says here, again, they hold a cyclical view of human affairs in the sense that they started to look into history far more at this time, right? They started to look into what came before us as Greeks, what came before our society. And it seems that a lot of the problems they were facing were faced by previous generations as well, which contributed to this view of cycles, right? And that those cycles also contribute to this larger universal order that they view that they held. And so I think all of those elements are going to be vastly different today, where maybe we don't see it as cyclical. You know, a lot of people like to say nowadays that history doesn't repeat itself, but it rhymes, right? So things will be similar across history due to our nature or whatever, however you want to classify it, but they won't necessarily be identical. So, and then there's the whole concept of the city and the society, right? Which comes after that. So like you read for Aristotle and for Plato, you begin with the family. Oikonomia is the word they had for it. It's the derivative, the word economics today is derivative of the Greek word oikonomia, though they aren't really the same thing. For the Greeks, oikonomia is sort of management of your estate, of your household. And so some people who are considered citizens, that is land-owning males for the most part, were supposed to sort of remove themselves from any administrative managing kind of affairs. They left slaves and women for that so that they could participate in philosophy and politics, that kind of thing. So progress for them really was going out into the city, talking to people, sharing ideas, and trying to figure out what the world is really about, right? And so these ideas of development, of human rights for everyone, of all that kind of thing, clearly doesn't play as big a role. Not only that, but you were talking about there are a number of elements that won't equate because the worlds are just so vastly different, right? And then one last thing I wanted to mention is you were talking about different forms of government, right, that are unstable, and that's something we'll probably get into in a little bit. But all of these elements are going to be vastly different. So if we're going to conceptualize progress today at all, though people like Mikey might be skeptical that we can, it definitely won't look like it did for the Greeks.
I think that's something interesting to lock onto and talk about for a bit is the instability of government in the ancient world.
Yeah,
because in the modern sense, especially in the West, we see the government as being very stable, as something that has existed for at least 100 years in most Western countries. I mean, there's the phrase, you know, like the two things you can always rely on are death and taxes. And so this idea that our system of government is going to continue on almost inevitably, its stability is almost taken for granted. Whereas in the ancient world, that often was not the case. It was much more consistent to see that, well, you'd have one person rise to power in a form and form their kind of government, and then you'd have someone else rise to power and they'd form their form of government, and then you'd have various periods in between, and there wasn't a lot of continuity between different governments. especially in Greece, the area where Athens and Sparta and many other Greek city-states were formed, every city essentially had its own set of laws and sense of government, and there was a lot of independent oversight, so to speak, like not a lot of overlap or standardization in terms of how the cities had to be run. Although it is very true that most of them you would consider to be a mix of what we would call today oligarchy or monarchy. So you'd have either one person who would be ruling the city or the surrounding area, or you'd have a group of people, usually landowners, as you were saying, usually male, who would run most of the city, and then they would usually have some kind of city council to decide debates, where they would debate and discuss how they should manage their city. So I'll just add on a little bit here, because one of the things I did in my world history course was read the Constitution of Athens. So the city of Athens actually kind of starts out with the dynamic use, which might not have occurred exactly the same in all other city states. And this is kind of what we mean when we say that history rhymes, but history doesn't always stay the same, is that we expect to see similar patterns, but we never expect to see the exact same historical events as we've seen in the past, because history flows. So when we say history rhymes, what we really mean is we mean that we expect to see similar patterns, but in different contexts and different situations as time moves on, rather than saying that history repeats itself, because that, for that to be literally true, we'd be talking about the exact same people living through multiple spaces of time. And that really doesn't work very well conceptually when we have a linear frame of time. So going back to Athens, the Constitution in Athens, which was a code of laws developed more or less by a merchant by the name of Solon, was developed to bring peace between essentially the poorer citizens of Athens and the richer citizens of Athens. The richer citizens of Athens had begun a practice of essentially taking someone's citizenship away if they could not pay their debts. So there were a group of citizens who were consolidating essentially all of the wealth of Athens and taking away the citizenship of other citizens. And so this had basically caused riots in the city. And so Solon came into the situation and was kind of appointed to be mediator between the poorer citizens and the richer citizens. And what he developed was a new ruling structure and a new code of laws for Athens, which he called the Constitution, which he then gave the Athenians to carry out. And this is where the Athenians got their idea of the democratic assembly, where all citizens had a right to vote. And one of the first things that Solon did is he basically annulled all debts and made it illegal, the practice that you could lose your citizenship to debt. So you could no longer lose your citizenship for having an outstanding loan. So that created what we now call the direct democratic Athens that ran by this constitution. There were periods in Athens history in the future where it would then uphold the constitution, and then someone might come along and usurp the constitution and become a tyrant. This is actually where we get the word tyranny as well, which is interesting that we both get the term for this government systems, you could say, of tyranny and democracy, both from ancient Athens. So then a tyrant would come along and then rule by their own might and their own will rather than by the constitution. But then the interesting thing in Athens is that the constitution doesn't become completely usurped by a tyrant and then go away. What happens actually is the people of Athens, after a tyrant displeases them, they return to the constitution. And so we see this cycle in Athens history. And it's kind of interesting to think about that. That observed cycle of instability is kind of matches up quite succinctly with the pre-Enlightenment idea of progress. And so in our last show, we talked a little bit about how an idea of a universal history, a history of all humanity, informs usually our idea of progress. And so I think this is a little bit of what we're seeing here, is Aristotle's idea of universal history of the city of Athens, from his experience, exposited onto history, although maybe going a little bit too far.
Yeah, I was gonna say, I think again, they had this already at the time, they had a conception of history that extended beyond their own current experience. So to call it universal might be a stretch. But, you know, the reason that we might draw differences, again, between what you just described and what we call progress today is to return to those three concepts that you mentioned in the first episode. This particular article, anyway, suggests that progress has sort of three main questions that you have to start with. Does the theory under consideration rigorously define a concept of human well-being? And if so, what is it? What causes of long-term improvement, and especially what laws of historical development does the theorist propose? And what evidence or reasons do the theorist provide for the aforementioned causal account? And I think if you're looking at that, Aristotle might fall under the first one, that you're defining. Clearly, they had some concept of human well-being that was being trampled upon by their treatment under this sort of mercantilistic approach to citizenry, right? Taking people's debts in account and removing their citizenship. Clearly, there was something there that people were feeling mistreated, that their well-being was in jeopardy, and that a constitution would help to resolve that, right? But it's not clear to me that that shows what comes next in the long term, right? Or that there's an underlying theory there. And so, again, when we're talking about this, it's very much more, as you said, a cyclical kind of view of what's happening rather than a forward-thinking concept of progress, of the human species or human condition as a whole, right? And I'm not saying that they didn't think of that necessarily, but this is just one case where that's not entirely clear to me. And so that's why you might be thinking about progress a little bit differently in the two cases. However, I think there's some striking similarities there where, you know, there was a need, again, some kind of well-being related need not being met. And their approach was, okay, let's implement a system that forces people, in a sense, to respect this idea that we have of well-being and that is returned to in the long term, right? So they make a change for their society in order to have a significant and consistent rise in the level of well-being of their society over time, right? And so in a sense, that's I think it's not hard to call that progress in a way, right? That being said, all of Aristotle's forms of government were highly unstable by nature, right? So I think people don't necessarily know this about Aristotle, but democracy was actually a bit of a bad word back then, because either the society was ruled by one person, monarchy in a good way or tyranny in a bad way, by a small group of people, aristocracy, named after, of course, Aristotle, or oligarchy, if it only benefits those few that are ruling, or popular government, polity in a good way, or democracy in a bad way, which is a kind of anarchic, you know, mob rule. And in each of these cases, though there is a good outcome for these different forms of government, it's clear that there will be conflicting concepts, conflicting desires, conflicting concepts of how the society should be ruled between the rulers and the people, or between previous, like former rulers and future rulers. And so there is a sense in which there is a kind of instability there that sort of makes very difficult the project of building a progression in society. That being said, I think, again, where you really see progress shine in any sense in this ancient Greek society is in their philosophy, their thinking, the way that they wanted to constantly improve their knowledge, right? Because I think that's something we took very much from the Greeks, and it's something we continue today, is we take the knowledge that we currently have and we seek more answers to the questions that we still have. You know, often seeking for answers gives us more questions, and building that knowledge over time is foundational to progress, right? Because if you don't have new information, how are you going to develop new technologies to try new modes of governance or of treating people, create constitutions and bills of rights and all this kind of thing? So I think their progress of thought was definitely something to keep in mind as an example of what progress could look like, whether or not they were able to sort of apply it in a broader social context, given the instability of their forms of governance, as well as all the conflicts they had with other city states, right? It's hard to say. I could be convinced that maybe that's not progress the way at least is defined in this particular article, but definitely the progress of thought is something to keep in mind.
All right, interesting thoughts. Let's read a little bit more and see what else the article has to say. Large-scale natural events also play an important role in Plato and Aristotle's presentation of human affairs. In The Statesman, Plato adopts the traditional Greek story of a golden age and a subsequent decline, written down by Hesiod in the Works and Days. Hesiod tells the story of five races of men, the golden race, the silver race, the bronze race, the demigods, and the iron race. The golden race is the best of all, and the present race, the iron race, is the worst. According to Plato's story, the ages described by Hesiod correspond to parts of a cycle during which the earth rotates first in one direction and then in another. While the earth moves in the first direction, the gods oversee the affairs of mankind as a herdsman looks after his flock. The gods tend to the needs of human beings. Because they are under the perfect care of the gods, humans do not need to govern themselves. Plato suggests that the Golden Age, the era of the Golden Race, occurred during such a period. When the earth changes course, a period of chaos ensues, which corresponds to the end of a Golden Age. Finally, when the earth moves in the second direction, people are left on their own, which explains the other ages as described by Hesiod. In the Laws, Plato does not return to this elaborate myth, but endorses the view that the human race has been repeatedly annihilated by floods and plagues and many other causes, so that only a fraction of it survived. Aristotle also entertains the possibility of periodic flooding and suggests that myths may contain the remnant of the wisdom of destroyed civilizations.
Okay. This is really interesting to me as someone who likes studying mythology and comparative culture and that kind of thing. It's a very modern take, especially that very last sentence, that myths may contain the remnants of the wisdom of destroyed civilizations, right? It's a very modern take, I think, on the way we study history. However, as you can see, this kind of myth, for those that are interested in myths like these and how these stories are similar across cultures, I definitely recommend the works of Joseph Campbell, for example, The Hero with a Thousand Faces, which suggests that stories like these are actually to be found in many cultures across time periods, including in the modern day, in their stories and their storytelling. With myths like these, it's pretty clear to see that progress as a rise in human civilization in all spheres is pretty clearly out of the picture here, it replaced with this state of decline, right? So that's where I think we can say that progress didn't have as much of a place in this pre-Enlightenment thought if you're already believing that you're in the decline of this universal cycle.
Yeah, it does seem like the idea that human beings would even be able to govern themselves at all in a successful manner is discounted. We still make mistakes, we're still flawed human beings, but that there is a possibility for redemption in these larger human stories, that we can essentially learn from our mistakes and create a better future.
That's a good point. That's a good point, this idea of redemption, because that features quite prominently, I think, in things like when you talk about virtue ethics, right? And this idea of being a virtuous person, unless you take the view that making any mistake at all in your action on virtue means you're not virtuous, which is one interpretation that any mistake means you lack virtue and that no one is able of attaining perfect virtue. A more sort of generous way of describing it is that though we may make mistakes, what matters is that we can improve. By the end of your life, if you're net virtuous as opposed to net unvirtuous, this idea of redemption I think is a good one to bring up, because it features again, like I said, in a lot of the writings from this time period, even though they may say that the decline is imminent. What's interesting as well to me is that they say pre-Enlightenment thought in this article and only really discuss Plato and Aristotle, and then, as we'll get to shortly, St. Augustine of Hippo, which is about 4th, 5th century of the Common Era. What I think is interesting is that a lot of other things happened between Plato and the Enlightenment, right? To give a sort of idea of that, so Plato and Aristotle were part of the ancient Greek society, right? So Plato lived in about, the 5th or the 4th century, I guess, BC. So he was born in 428, 424 BC, not really sure. Died about 348 BC. And Aristotle, of course, was his successor. And between that, for almost 500 years prior to the Common Era and the Age of Enlightenment, which were the 17th and 18th centuries, that's a lot of time. As Western philosophers and Western thinkers, what's been really interesting for me to expand my thinking and my knowledge is to consider other cultures and their enlightenments. Because let's take, for example, the Islamic Golden Age, right? Which traditionally dated from about 8th century to 13th century of the Common Era. Now, in this period, Islamic thought in all spheres of human life it flourished in a lot of ways. And we have a lot of theories that could be attributed to thinkers from the Western world that really were actually said by either Islamic thinkers or thinkers from China, Japan, India, right? Prior to the Western thinkers to whom we attribute them. Let's talk, for example, about Adam Smith, right? Adam Smith, economics, modern, capitalism, that's what we attribute it to. But a lot of what he said could be attributed to thinkers like Ibn Khaldun from the Islamic Enlightenment period. And what's interesting to me is that while the Greeks may not have had progress in the same way that we would have it today, or that we might have it in the Enlightenment, which we'll talk about next show, and I'll dive maybe a bit more into the Islamic Golden Age in the next episode, there's a lot of room between the two for progress to change and develop. I just kind of wanted to put it out there as a disclaimer that, even though we're talking about maybe a group of people at a certain time to whom progress meant little, let's say, in a sort of universal sense, there's a lot of room in there for progress to change. And I think it's beneficial for us to see it as gradual. And the reason I say that is because progress, even the concept of progress, is something that can change and grow over time. So in a meta sense, progress itself can progress depending on what we see are the most pressing obstacles or threats and what are the most valuable benefits to us in our current society. And to sort of say that Plato and Aristotle didn't believe in progress, and then all of a sudden in the Enlightenment, Descartes said, let there be progress. I don't know, you know what I mean? That seems a little bit... I want to say that that's maybe not the best way to think about it. Because to trace it gradually allows us to identify more specific changes, I think, that allow us to see what progress meant to different people at different times.
We'll just break here to say you have been listening to the Canadian Philosophy Show. My name is Aaron Wang, and today I'm joined by Mihai Kovasser. This is our second episode on our series on the ideas of progress. So we have been talking about pre-Enlightenment views on the idea of progress and having a little bit of a recap on the conceptualization of progress, which is kind of our overarching theme for this series. Most of what we've been talking about has been from Plato and Aristotle, and Mihai responded that this article kind of pushes aside a lot of other history and ideas that might be applicable to the idea of progress. Just to sketch out some of the other points and some of the other lines of history you could potentially go with here. In between Plato and the Enlightenment and Aristotle, what we have, and this in fact is probably one of the reasons why we have Plato and Aristotle, what we have most importantly, you could say, is the Greek Golden Age, so to speak. So Aristotle was famously attributed to be the tutor of the person known as Alexander the Great, who became a very widely known figure in the ancient age, mainly because he